around. It looks like what good. And you know, some time ago, a month, somebody sent me a question. And I looked at it and I said, what a question this is. Father's name, mother's name, name, and how many children and where they went to school and all that. And I couldn't see the relevance. As you probably got the thing back. I said, stupid question there. But I'll give you anything you want.
Well, some of that information is interesting to get an overall picture of things. But, you know, I understand what your feelings are. And why don't we begin then by indicating today is February 14th, 1995. And this is Jim Boning speaking with Vincent Gregory in his office at the Roman House Building in Philadelphia. I know that you were born in Oil City, Pennsylvania, but I think the year is 1923.
That's right.
But I don't know what date.
It was June 10th, 1923. June 10th. I will give you two or three words of my childhood, if
okay.
you like.
Something of your parents and your family. Perhaps.
Yeah, well, I was one of nine children. And my mother and father, my father's parents came from Germany, so he was an son of an immigrant group, and my mother's were farmers, and neither one of them had education beyond the fourth grade. They were farmers, so they raised this family of nine during the Depression, which was heavy going.
Sure.
And it made a big difference to me because it meant that my dad was out of work during the Depression, so that all of us worked, and I had summer jobs and weekend jobs ever since I could remember. That helped. And it comes to another question that. Do you want me to run through your list here?
Well,
do I run out, or do you?
I would like to go through your career a little bit chronologically.
Okay.
I think that may answer some of those, and then
okay.
we can come to the list and look at the ones we haven't covered
okay.
as we look at your career. You went to school in Oil City then?
That's right. I went to Oil City High School, graduated
okay.
in 1941.
And it would have been June or May or June 41,
June 41
so the war
right.
hadn't really started yet.
That's right, exactly.
Things were already heating up in Europe.
Right.
What was it like in high school at that time, and was there anybody who influenced you during that early part of your life?
Well, I think quite a few people. There were 320 people in my class during the junior and the senior year, and I was president of my class for both years, and I, valedictorian, we call it something else then, but that's what I graduated with in 1941 when I came out. And this kind of is important because the previous year as a junior, I got a scholarship to Princeton, and I couldn't make up my mind whether I wanted to go to Princeton or go to the Catholic priesthood. I also had an academic scholarship to Notre Dame. A lot of pressure to be a priest and go to Notre Dame, but I decided I would go to Princeton. So I went to Princeton in 1941 in September, and then the war started in December.
What about financing? Your Princeton would not have been inexpensive.
Well, I had a scholarship.
So
it was a competitive scholarship.
Okay.
That I took. An oil man named Scheide had granted this scholarship, and it paid for all of my tuition and services. And then I had, as soon as I got down there, I hitchhiked to get to Princeton, and I got three jobs, and I paid for my room and board.
Okay.
And that way, so I paid for the whole thing.
What kind of jobs were you doing?
Well, in the dining hall. If you worked as a waiter, if you worked 13 or 14 meals, you got all your food. And I worked 21 meals a week, and the other I got cash for. And then I was working for the College Entrance Examination Board. I was a guinea pig for tests. They tested my IQ and what I could do, and then I would take tests, and they would put my score in.
Okay.
I didn't have computers, but whatever they did put them in those days. And I had a couple other jobs. I forget what they were, but I was working all the time.
That didn't give you time for any extracurricular. What time for extracurricular?
I was in the band, Princeton band. That was about it.
What had you picked economics as a major that early, or were you still thinking about what?
No,
you
I was still thinking that the priesthood would be a possibility, and that's why I continued. I took Latin all the way through high school. I took another year of Latin at Princeton, But I only had 1 year at Princeton before I went into the U.S. Army Air Forces.
Okay.
So I hadn't decided on economics or anything. At Princeton, in those days, probably still is, the first 2 years were completely general, humanities and so forth. So I had a couple languages, history, political science, that type of thing.
Okay.
So that the idea of a career, the only career decision I had to make was the fundamental one. Are you going to go in the priesthood or are you going to go in business? And I was strongly influenced on the business side by the fact that we'd had it so tough during the Depression with all those kids that I thought, I'm going to get a job and make enough money. I don't have to go through that again. So I had that in the back of my mind even that first year at Princeton.
Okay. Did any of your siblings enter the priesthood or the religious order?
No, none of them. None of them did.
How'd your parents react to that? I'm assuming that's where the pressure
was. No, not so much. My parents, were very... I think my mother wanted me to go into the priesthood, but my father did not. But they never put any pressure on me. The pressure came from the priests, the local priests, who I knew real well and known all my life, and those that had been there. So that pressure came from them, but I decided against it, especially with when I had a chance to go into the war and be a pilot. I was a fighter pilot in the war.
You enlisted then. When the Pearl Harbor was December 7th,
I think I tried to enlist the next month, but by that time the Air Force still you had to have a college degree to go into pilot training that early in the war. So I joined the Royal Canadian Air Force, but I never got called. By the time that they were going to call me for the Royal Canadian Air Force, the U.S. Air Force was recruiting, and they let you get in without your degree. So I went into the U.S. Air Force in 42.
So you were 19?
I guess so, yeah.
Born in
June of 23, that's right.
So you were only 19 when you entered the Air Force.
That's right,
Where'd you have your pilot training?
Oh, got it. Well, first of all, the cadet schools were all full, so they cut out the cadet program, and they sent me to Western Reserve for pre-cadet training. That was 3 or 4 months, and then Keesler Field, Mississippi, I guess, for some basic training first, and then the pilot training, Muskogee, Oklahoma, was primary, and Coffeyville, Kansas, was basic, and then Moorfield, Mission, Texas, was advanced, and then down in the for fighter training at Colorado Springs, and then down in the Gulf of Mexico, Amagorda Island, for gunnery training. And then to England.
I didn't realize that it went through that many different places. Geez,
yes, in those days, I think they only have two now. They combined primary and basic. But no, we had three different. And then, of course, you had to do the transfer between the fighters and then in the gunnery training, and it took a long time.
When did you get to England then?
44.
44. And flying?
I was flying. That's when I met the P-51 for the first time, because we were flying P-40s in the south. I'd never seen a P-51.
Okay.
And the first one I saw was in England, and it had a bubble canopy. You know, you could look. I just was in heaven when I saw that thing. And they said it was plexiglass. Well, I didn't know plexiglass from anything. And then later, of course, I come to work for Roman Haas, who invented plexiglass, Dr. Rome did. And not only that, Roman Haas made the first bubble canopies for the P-51D out of our Bristol plant until the Air Force got things lined up and got a manufacturer to make them. So that was interesting. Later on, that became an interesting fact.
Did you see much action?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, we would escort bombers. See, the P-51 was the only fighter the Allies or anybody had that could take the bombers to Berlin and bring them back. We could fly 8 hours.
Okay.
In the Battle of Britain, the Spitfire could fly 30 minutes, an hour at the most. And by the time we came along there in 44, we could fly 8 hours. Now, we couldn't go to Berlin, it didn't take 8 hours to go to Berlin, but to fly 8 hours, we later did some bombing, dive bombing around and strafing around Munich. We put two wing tanks on with gasoline, fuel, and then we would drop those, and then we would machine gun and have a belly bomb for dive bombing. And if we didn't have those on, we would have two bombs on there. We'd have to go so far, but we could go 8 hours. That's a long time.
That's, there's not much room.
No, that's right.
Well, what, B-17, were they?
P-51.
No, but I mean the bomber.
Oh, yeah, the B-17, right. Yeah. B-17s, yeah, that's right. And then we were also dive bombers and strafing, although the P-47 was more designed for that than the P-51.
What unit were you with? What was the...
374th Fighter Squadron, as I recall. I think it's on a big painting out here.
Okay, I just saw that briefly. Yeah. I'll have to look at it when we go out. And I understand you met your wife when you were in England.
That's right. I was stationed right outside of Cambridge, and she lived in Cambridge, and I met her at an afternoon dance, and she and her mother couldn't make up their mind whether they were going to marry me or not, so when the war ended in Europe, it was 50 years ago this year, and my outfit was on its way to the Pacific, I stayed until they could decide, and went over to the continent and did some work over there, flying artillery piles by around and gathering up there. That's another story. I don't know whether it's significant for this or not. But my wife did decide to, she would marry me. Then I had her wedding dress made out of my parachute.
Oh,
that's interesting.
Wow.
Because there wasn't any nylon or silk in England. And I had her a wedding dress made out of my parachute. I wasn't flying P-51s then. I was flying a C-64 Norseman, which is a Canadian plane. And that could hold 8 people plus the pilot. And I had these 8 artillery pilots, and we would go and land in fields where the artillery planes were, and I had a mechanic, he'd fix them up. They'd fly them to a place, central place in Germany, and then I'd go pick them up, and this was the job. So I was flying without my parachute, but it was down the ground being made into a wedding dress in Munich. And one time I needed it and didn't have it, so I landed by the grace of God. There wasn't anything there. So I was a guy's father dying, and I wanted to get him to Frankfurt to get home. And we were flying from Munich. And because of my job, I had a card from the commanding general of the Ninth Air Force. I could land and take off anywhere, because I had to. It was cow pasture work. And they said at Munich Airport, no, you can't go through the front. And I said, I'll be through that before it gets there. We only had one means of communicating, a radio. And the old beam, damn radio goes out. And this guy wouldn't bail out when he found out I didn't have a parachute, so he wrote it down with me, and we were lucky. And we got close enough that they took him into Frankfurt in a Jeep, and he got home in time to see his father before he died. So it's worth the parachute.
Okay.
And it got made into a wedding dress, and she got married. We got married.
What was her reaction when she heard that story?
I didn't tell her that for a long time.
I understand why. when were you out of the military?
Well, then we came back in 1946, and I started back at Princeton. They had summer courses then, and Princeton gave me a year's credit for the work I'd done before. Is that all right?
Yeah. I just check it from time to time.
Gave me a year's credit for the work I'd done at Princeton before the war, and a year's credit for general experience I had, and I guess in shooting Germans. I figured you ought to get more than a year for doing that, but and then they had the 3 terms a year, summer one and accelerated. So I was accelerating, but I had 2 years to make up. And my roommate from before the war had got back early and had finished and was going to go to the Harvard Law School. And he was going up for get some final things finished. So I went up with him, and this is 1947, early 47, because he came back married, and our wives became good friends, so we had a nice little thing there with 2 families. So I went up with him and walked in off the street to the Harvard Business School, which I'd heard about. And I said, look, I said, I'm married, I'm a Catholic, we can't use birth control, I have so many kids, by the time I get out of Princeton, I won't be able to afford to come here. What's the chance of getting in without my degree from Princeton? I mean, this was straight off the wall. But they talked to me for the whole day, dean of admissions, three deans and four professors, and they said at the end, well, if everything checks out, we'll let you in here this fall without your degree from Princeton. So I went back, and at Princeton, they said, okay, well, you can do that. And I said, but can I get my Princeton degree? Well, if you come here in the summers. That's the reason I strung this out, because it is interesting. So I went to Princeton in the summers and Harvard in the winter, and I got my MBA from Harvard Business School a week before I got my BA from Princeton in 1949. So that's how they all tied together.
That's amazing, because as I saw that, I was really wondering how you managed to pull that one off.
You couldn't do it now, but they were a little more... And you know, we'd had a lot of experience.
Sure.
So that meant, you know, that I worked like hell. And then I went directly from there to... I never went to either graduation. Came to work for Roman Haas on July 1st, 1949.
So you had this three-year period, getting Princeton degree, the MBA at Harvard, and
right.
What were your thoughts about a career during this time?
Well, then during that period, I had this thing, the Horatio Alger feeling from the Depression. God, I want a job where I can make some money and support a family. So I kept thinking about that. That tilted me towards the Harvard Business School when I was at Princeton. I got Phi Beta Kappa at Princeton my junior year, and I was told that I could get that I was in line for a Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford. And I said, look, I can't afford to go to Oxford. I got to go to Harvard and make some money as fast as I can. Of course, we had the GI Bill then, but my wife worked and I worked and we got through. So I was thinking of a career by that time, but it wasn't necessary. And what I really thought about as I put my plans together the last year or so when I was at Harvard and at Princeton was, one, I don't want to go to a huge company. I want to go in an industry that's growing, and that's how I came out with the chemical industry, even though I didn't have a technical background. But that's how then I picked Roman Haas out of a group of companies because, it was recommended by General Dorio, who was one of my professors at the Harvard Business School. And it was a small company, it was small in those days. And it had an excellent management record, so it looked like a good bet. And that's how I picked Roman Haas. Had an offer from DuPont and several other offers because they were pretty easy to get jobs then, but I picked Roman Haas. Company size and the management record.
Did you come here for an interview prior to getting a job offer?
Oh yeah, they interviewed me at the business school.
Okay.
The former treasurer, and actually I wasn't too impressed with him. He's still alive, so I won't. But he sat there looking at the ceiling the whole time, and I thought, what the hell's going on up there? But and then I came down for an interview, and the guy that impressed me was the executive vice president or financial vice president then, I guess, but Duncan Merriweather. Great guy, and he gave me a bunch of BS about he had these 10-year strategic plans down here, and they needed some of these Harvard MBAs to help them out. And later, he became a close friend, and he told me that was all bullshit. He didn't have any plans there at all. But that influenced me to come with Roman Haas, and I never regretted it.
What was your first assignment then?
My first assignment was in what they called the Plan Accounting Supervisors Group, and they had a chunk of the financial division that was responsible for the accounting and the financial work in the plans. And this same group was responsible for internal auditing. So from I started July 1st, 1949. For the first 6 months, I went to two or three of the plants, and did auditing work at the plants. And then I had a couple special assignments at the factories too. And then for the year 1950, I spent 6 months at our Philadelphia plant, which is just across the river over there, and 3 months and then another month at the Bristol plant. And then the year 1951, I spent at the Knoxville plant. So I had a lot of experience very early in number one, auditing, which gave me an overview of the company, and two, in the plant operating methods, but in the financial division. And that was until 1952, when I was sent to Europe to start our first manufacturing plant outside the United States. Now that kind of, my career breaks down into three chunks. That's the first chunk, those 2.5 years up to 52. And then 52 to 68, I was in Europe. I went over to, I won't give you, there's a, it was a fun one. I was,
well,
some,
I,
yeah.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I'd like to come back to those first 3 years if I could.
Sure.
And because you were out in the plants, what was your reaction to being, you weren't sitting in an office crunching numbers, you were actually out talking to people in the plants.
That's right.
And what was your reaction to that? How did you feel about doing that?
Well, I thought it was great. The Philadelphia plant was the first one I went to. And, God, it was awful. It was an old plant. It had been there 100 years, or somebody had it for 100 years. And the odors were pretty bad. I thought, geez, I don't want to work here the rest of my life. But I really did enjoy that plant. I learned a hell of a lot about the people and what they were doing, and I made friends with them, and it just was great experience. And the same thing at the Bristol plant and the Knoxville plant. They made me the assistant plant accounting supervisor. I guess be the assistant controller at that plant, and I was responsible for putting all new accounting procedures in. And we were making a lot of plexiglass with different sizes. Oh, it was a hell of a mess. And I did that work. And again, I mean, I really enjoyed working with the people and learning how they thought and what they did, which was great to have at the beginning of my career, right? Smack the manufacturing folks. So I enjoyed that.
And it could be crucial because you could have been sitting in an office here in Philadelphia.
That's right.
Instead, and never have that feel, which...
Exactly.
Do you know why you got tapped to go to Europe in 52?
Yeah, sure. I was called up from Knoxville, and I was scared to death. I mean, what the hell do they want me in pulled up from Knoxville for? I didn't do it. So my boss down there, he said, listen, he said, this company, he said, is so cheap. He said, if they were going to fire you, they use a 2-cent stamp. That's what we needed in those days to send you a letter. So they're not paying your way to go up to Philadelphia to fire you. So something else, actually he knew, but he couldn't tell me. So the guy that I met, who was later became my boss for about 20 years, he said they had this chance that they needed somebody to go to France to help the engineer build our first plant outside the United States. And it would be a 3-year assignment to find an office and to set up an office and all that. So I said, oh, that'd be perfect. And he said, but there are 53 people in line for this job, so it's going to take a few weeks to sort it out, and what a competition. I said, okay, so I was introduced and interviewed by quite a few people, and actually I was sitting with the executive vice president then, the son of the elder son of the founder of
Roman,
Dr. F. Otto Haas, right. And in the afternoon, and all at once, God, something happened, and they, where's Gregory? They grabbed me out of poor Otto had an office about the third in size of this. They pulled me out. Mr. Haas, God wants to see you. I never met him, but I mean, he was like God. So I went in to see him. I could hardly understand him. This German was a, so he said, Mr. Gregory, he said, you want this job in France? And I said, yes, sir. He said, why do you want it? I said, well, I think it'd be a wonderful experience. I think I could do a lot of good for the company over there if I could go over. And I would certainly, he said, how soon can you go? And I said, well, I said, my clothes are all down in Knoxville. I said, but I could get a shirt and toothbrush. I could leave in the morning. I guess this was, you know, BS. But he said, oh, he said, you could. I said, yeah. He said, okay. He said, you go tell Mr. Murphy you've got the job. And I said, Mr. Murphy told me he's got 53 other people he's going to interview. He said, you tell Mr. Murphy. I said, he's a silly boy. So I go, oh, Murphy, the larger, he was a great guy. And I walked in his office and sat down. I looked at him, and he said, what happened? I said, he gave me the job. And he said, I figured he would. I said, well, damn it, you said 53. Ah, we started to laugh. He said, dude, we didn't have anybody. They didn't tell me then. I found out later they didn't have anybody else. And I think the way that they figured it out, one was Harvard Business School, and the second one was my wife was from England, and they looked at a map, and England was close to France. So they thought, well, that's a big deal. He knew all about France. But I think that was it. You see how important those 2 years were to me, though, in being able to condense that education at Harvard and Princeton, because if I had not been there in 49 with a couple years at Roman Haas, I wouldn't have been considered. And it was the experience in Europe, 52 to 68, that we haven't talked about yet, but it was that experience that made it, made me the next CEO of the company in 1970. So it was a very important period of time, and I was very fortunate in the timing of it.
Was that your only meeting with Dr. Haas? Or
which, the old man?
Yes.
Well, no, I met with him. I went to France, and I didn't get back for 3 years, but I came back. And then after I got back the first time, I came back 3 or 4, and I saw him several times. After, you know, he'd always have lunch with me and a group of people. And he was a tough old bird. He really was tough.
I was going to ask if you had the feeling, even that in those early days, of his dominance in terms of the company.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have lunch, all the senior people of the company, and he would have lunch with them, the 6 or 8 of them, and these guys who outside his office, I mean, they were gods in their own right, but with Mr. Haas, they were little boys. He just, nobody contradicted him. He told them what. He was trying to get me to criticize my boss, and well, I guess that was a little bit later. By the time I moved to England, I had a boss for a while in England. He was trying to get me to criticize him because he got an apartment near Grosvenor Square. And the old man didn't like it. He said, he's wasted time. He comes to work late, doesn't he? No, Mr. Haas, he's come to work on time. He works very hard. He's very good. And he's doing a good job for the company. And he was hammering. Every time I come over, he tried to get it. And I found out later he was pissed off at this guy for some reason. And he wanted me to criticize it. I wouldn't do it. No, he made all the decisions. You know, just to finish that off, you know, when he was on his deathbed, he still hadn't designated his successor. And they were going to have a... Then he made up his mind what he was going to do, and make the chairman of the, make the head of research, Dr. Connor, the chairman of the board, and make his son, Dr. F. Otto Haas, Otto, make him the president and chief executive officer. But he wasn't going to tell them except in a conference call board meeting, which they were going to have in 2 or 3 days from then. And he called his wife in, and he said, I'm not going to live for 3 days. Have the call now. So they had the call. He told him what his decision was, and the next day he died. Mm. That's cutting it pretty short.
It sure is. That could have been a real turmoil.
Yeah, that's right. Well, no, that wouldn't have been. Well, no, I think
with the two sons, there would have been.
The other son didn't have much. John, he was pretty junior, and he didn't have much to say about it, and didn't have anything to say about it. And he was terrified of his father. He wouldn't have said anything.
So you arrived in Paris in 1952.
Right.
Did you operate out of Paris?
Then the plant was near Fouchy-Lay, near Arras, in the northern part of France. And the first thing I did was start the company in the hotel room, in the Scrive Hotel, and we started, my wife and I were there, and we had our son, and he's three years old, I guess, then, and we lived in the Scrive for two or three months before I was able to find a pantry. I mean, there was no office space available in Paris then, but I got a pantry in the apartment house and a kitchen, and we set up office there, hired a secretary, and I was responsible for everything except the sales and the technical trials that were the ag product that they were going. You want to change that?